This is take two, side one, Lawrence Henderson interview, August 28th, 1989. We were just discussing the perception that Rand, Project Rand, should be spun off as an independent entity.
Yeah.
Were these kinds of comments from the academic community hindering your efforts to recruit the people that you wanted?
Oh, I would think so, yes. How seriously, I don't know. I was surprised at the number of people who were willing to accept that. I was kind of surprised that there wasn't more. I'm a professor at Yale. I don't want to go to work for an aircraft company or what have you. I didn't have the feeling that was very strong, but I did have the feeling that this is very peculiar. It isn't right somehow. If what you say you're doing and what your ambitions are for what you would like to do are the way they are, how can you do this as a division of an aircraft company? I mean, that's the feeling that I had. In other words, I thought it was somewhat of a hindrance, but it wasn't anywhere near as strong a feeling as the competitive feeling in connection with the industry problem. But then we went into the long song and dance of, should we try to be affiliated with the university? Should we become entirely independent? How should we set ourselves up? And I think most of us felt that. On one of my notes, I made a list of things, pros and cons of independence. And of course, the con was we didn't have a dime to start with. We didn't know whether we could get any financial support from a foundation, and being associated with the university would be great in terms of having a father to look after you and so on. Fortunately, we didn't do that. I mean, I think that judgment was exactly right in hindsight.
How seriously was that option considered?
I don't know. I think fairly seriously, although I think that there was a fairly strong feeling at that point, as there had been early on, that universities, either then or in the future, were not going to want to get involved in classified research, and that therefore that would be a major hindrance, even if they set it up separately, as some of the university, Lincoln Laboratory and so on.
Did Rand enter into any discussions with any university regarding this point?
I don't believe there were any formal discussions at all. It probably is true that both Rowan and Frank talked to some of their friends about it. I don't recall ever having done that myself at all. But I wasn't, well, I guess I was involved in it pretty much, but I don't think there was any direct contact. I think those of us who worked in Rand felt that if we could find the wherewithal to stand on our own feet, that we could stand on our own feet fine, that we didn't need a university with all of the problems. I knew something about the management of universities because I'd watched my father and the faculty problems, and President Lowell is a close friend of his, as I say, and I knew a lot about the selection of Jim Conant as president because he was married to my first cousin, and so on and so forth. So that, I had a feeling that a university, however great and good it is, was not necessarily a haven for flexibility of management and independence, in a sense. I don't think I would have recommended that we be part of a university in any event.
Were there any other options considered besides affiliation with the university or independence?
Government obviously was out. That was clearly, we didn't want to get into the bureaucracy. That was, you know, no way. Which was the reason, of course, for founding Project RAND in the first place, in a sense. I don't know what other options there are. Affiliation with some industrial company that in no way is competing, like McDonald's or Johnson & Johnson or something like that. No, I don't think there was any. We knew about the Battelle Institute, which was a very successful operation then, and I guess still is very successful. And so that we knew that there were research organizations, at least, which could be independent and operate all right. I think I don't think anybody thought seriously about anything except independence or association with the university. And as I say, we pretty much dismissed that alternative early on. But then we had the problem of how the hell do we get the wherewithal so we can stand on our own feet, and that was a real problem. We went all over the place, as you undoubtedly know.
I've seen several different accounts of it, so I think it'd be worthwhile to get your recollections of how that transpired.
Well, we talked to the Carnegie Corporation, and they said no way. We talked to Warren Weaver at the Rockefeller, and he said no way. But they both recommended that we try the Ford Foundation, because they said the Ford Foundation doesn't really exist in any independent sense. All it is it's got a lot of money in escrow fighting with the IRS in the bank, and all it's doing is supporting the Ford Hospital and the Wayside Inn, Mr. Ford's personal charities, and they have a couple of outside trustees, but they haven't really decided what they're going to do when they get all the money that they're going to get, how they're going to operate, and so forth. And they haven't made any decision yet about what kinds of things they want to support. I mean, you know, most foundations have some sort of concentration of what they're interested in. And Ford had not yet made any kind of, or the people associated with Ford had not made any decision about what kinds of things that they really were interested in. So they said, this is a possible open door. And whether they can spring enough money to get you going, we don't know. But in any event, that's a real possibility. There aren't any other foundations that we can think of that would be appropriate or that have the wherewithal to do the kind of thing that you want. So there we were, pretty much stuck with Ford. We thought we had consulted almost everybody who had a knowledge about, not just Chuck Dollard and Warren Weaver, but a lot of other people who had associations with foundations and so on. And it seemed clear to us that that was about all we had. But then we thought to ourselves, well, maybe we're not totally out of luck, because we do know some people. We may not know Henry Ford II and Benson Ford, but we do know Carl Compton, and we know Don David, and Compton had just succeeded Rentschler as the second outside trustee of Ford, and that was a fortuitous thing for us, because we hadn't known Rentschler. And so we decided, well, what the hell, let's see what we can do. So it was decided that Arthur Raymond, who knew Carl Compton very well, because Arthur had been a very distinguished graduate of MIT, and Rowan, who of course knew Compton from the radiation laboratory days, would go see Compton, and that I would go see Don David, because he was a friend of mine, and I knew him very well. So that's what we did, and we got a kind of a half-hearted, well, we'll see kind of thing. Why don't you prepare a proposal and see what it, we'll see what it looks like, and then we'll decide whether to recommend to Henry and Benson Ford that they listen to you. And so that's what we went and did, and we finally prepared the proposal that's in there. And after showing it to David and Compton, they called up Henry Ford II, I guess, and said, you know, maybe you ought to listen to these people. They've got an interesting idea that it's different. And so I wrote Bert Craig, the treasurer, and sent him a copy of the proposal and so forth. And then he called me up, I guess, from Detroit and invited me to come out and talk to Henry and Benson Ford. And I don't know how it was decided that I would be the guy to do this alone, but I got stuck with it in any event. And so I went to Detroit, and they put me up at the Detroit Club and so on. And Mr. Craig came and picked me up in the morning and took me to the River Rouge plant. And the Henry Ford's office, and Benson came in, and the three of us sat there, and they looked at the proposal. I guess they had read it by then, so forth, and we discussed it at some length. And of course, they said, we don't have any money, you know, it's all in escrow, we don't have a dime, and so on. And I finally said, came down to the bare minimum, you know, the $100,000 plus the guarantee. And they said, no, we can't do that. And I said, well, then it's just not going to go. You know, we've just got to have that much to start with. And then they looked at each other and finally said, well, all right. So at that point, I breathed a deep sigh of relief and called Rowan Gaither on the phone to come and negotiate with their lawyers. They had a very nice law firm in Detroit that was handling the thing, and we got the thing written up. That was an interesting experience. We go through that kind of thing again.
So did you have to give a lengthy formal presentation on the virtues of this thing, or was it just...
Well, it wasn't formal. We're just sitting around. Yeah, you know, it wasn't formal. I suppose it was a presentation. No, I didn't have charts or anything of that sort. No, it was a conversation.
Just a conversation.
Among friends, yeah, essentially. Right. Oh, sure. No, they asked a bunch of questions, and I tried to answer them as best I could, and so forth. But David and Compton had talked to them, I think, you know, fairly favorably, or they wouldn't have gone that, because they didn't know what the hell to do. They didn't know what they were going to do with all this money. Establishing that foundation, they really had a problem. Not to mention the fact that it kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger and more of a problem. And they had more and more management problems with Paul Hoffman and all that business. So finally, that's how Rowan got involved in it, that they had met him. And they regarded, after a couple of years, they, at least Henry Ford II, regarded Rand as pretty good, because he came into this meeting all unbeknownst to Rowan. I'm sure you've heard this story. Came into the Ford Foundation meeting all unbeknownst to Rowan and said, you know, we gave him this $100,000 bid, and then we increased it to a $1 million loan, and which they had later on. And he said, this is the best thing the foundation has ever done. Let's turn that loan into a grant. And that's what they did. And Henry did this without Rowan knowing he was going to do it at all. He just out of the blue. So Ron almost fell off his chair. We said, well, that's great.
This was after Gaither had become...
Yes, after he had gotten involved with the foundation, yes. But but we had briefed Henry Ford a couple of times and so on, and he did know something about what we were doing and so forth. And I gather he got the feeling that unlike some of the other things that the foundation had tried to do, this was something that wasn't a headache, but was something good. So at that point, everything more or less fell into place, and we survived after that.
What role did you play as heading up the Washington office and making this transition from Project RAND to the corporation? Did it involve anything special on your part to see this thing through with the Air Force?
Yeah, oh sure. There was one thing we had to do was to transfer the contract, which still had a lot of money on it, from Douglas to the new corporation. And subsequent to the Civil War, as a result of all the crookedness involved in selling spoiled meat to the army, laws were passed prohibiting the transfer of government contracts, prohibiting the assignment of government contracts, because that was one of the major violations, like the present HUD scandal, whatever, one of the major violations that had happened. They'd let a contract to A, and he would assign it to B, and then B would provide spoiled meat to the army, and the soldiers would get sick and so on. So we had to find a way of circumventing that law. And we had a lot of discussions with, I in particular spent a lot of time with Bill Thurman, who was the general counsel of the Air Force at the time, William T. Thurman, T-H-U-R-M-A-N. And we tried to figure out, how we would word this thing and who would have to approve it and on and on. Of course, in order to do this, we had to we had to get ourselves set up as a corporation. Then we had to get a board of trustees, and we went around like mad, corralling everybody we could think of who was distinguished enough we thought to be a trustee and saying, will you? And I went to see my cousin Jim Conant, and he said, look, you've got Lee Dubridge, you don't need me. I'm too busy anyway. And I said, okay, I understand, but we would like very much to have you. And he said, well, okay, but no way. So we were stuck with Dubridge. I guess we got George Stoddard. He must have won. I guess he was one of the original ones. And, well, you have a list of the original trustees, of course, right? Yeah, the only conversation I recall is the one that I had was with Jim Conant, but I knew a lot of the other people, but Rowan and Arthur Raymond knew a lot of them better. Of course, I knew Lee Dubridge because he'd been the head of the radiation laboratory at MIT. I knew him very well. But having gotten the Board of Trustees and what we thought and hoped was enough financial backing, we then had to negotiate this transfer, which was quite a hairy business. We finally got everybody to agree, and we got a, I don't know whether we got a letter from the secretary, I guess, agreeing to the transfer. And then we were in business. But although there was quite a bit of discussion involved, Bill Thurman was quite helpful and it worked out.
Was the Air Force basically supportive, antagonistic towards this move? What was their feeling about it?
Well, they didn't quite understand it. A lot of them were supportive of it in the sense that they wanted to get it out of Douglas, because they could see from their point of view it was not a good idea. And so I think they were supportive, and I think they were reasonably impressed with the caliber of the trustees that we had picked up. So I think they were supportive, generally. I never had any feeling that there was any real antagonism in the Air Force toward the idea of independence. By that time, they'd gotten used to the fact that Project Rand was pretty damn independent anyway. You know what I mean? They hadn't been able to. They had tried to put pressure on Douglas to get Rand to do certain things. Well, that hadn't worked because Mr. Douglas wouldn't sit still for that. I think they would rather have negotiated with Douglas independently on other things, not having Rand there in the background as a potential problem for them. But I don't know. I don't have any feeling that there was any real antagonism in the Air Force. I think Ed Bowles was not wildly favorable, as I recall it. But as you see, Van Bush was, which was very helpful. That letter, I think, was very helpful.
Did the move to the reorganization of the defense establishment in this period when Rand was just getting started have any impact on the organization as the Air Force became an independent department?
No, curiously, I don't really think so. I think we had always more or less regarded the Army Air Forces as an independent agency, and although during the Bowles era and so on, and while the Army Air Forces was still part under the Secretary of War, we hadn't felt that there'd been any particular antagonism or difficulties in dealing with the hierarchy. And so when the thing was, when the Air Force was set up independently, it didn't make much difference to us, except we thought it was probably good, in the sense it would make our life simpler rather than complicating it, which was true until the Defense Department got, the Office of the Secretary of Defense became powerful, because they were not at the beginning.
Maybe this would be a sure. good point to conclude for today.
Sure,
pick up next time.
Fine.
Substantively.
Fine.
Time to rant.
Fine. Okay.